Birds are such a wonder to watch, aren't they, and to listen to. And at this time of year, there's so much activity as many birds start or continue their migratory trips, and others certainly getting ready to share that long, cold Wisconsin winter with us. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We usually have to wait for a holiday to enjoy talking about birds with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, but we are in luck today because not only are they with us for a special non-holiday bird show, they are here in the studio with me, which is a real treat. Noel Cutright is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. And Noel, great to have you with us today in the studio.
Great to be here, Larry. And look at your smiling face here across the microphones.
Yeah, usually we're just, these guys are usually with us by phone. Bill Volkert, our other guest. Bill's been watching and studying birds for over 40 years. He spent 27 years as a naturalist at Horican Marsh. Bill, always a pleasure for you to be with us, too.
Well, thank you, Larry. Great to be here.
I'm just so excited and happy to have you here. And you, as you listen in to our conversation, I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments or maybe stories to tell. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can also post a photo or a question on my Facebook page. For that, just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can post your photo or your question or comment right there. So the fall migration, When does it really begin, and when does it end in Wisconsin? Noel, you want
to... It really actually starts in July.
Wow.
That's why we try to concentrate on June to do breeding bird surveys, because that's kind of about the only time of the year, even though there's still migration going on the first week or two of June, that's the most stable time of year during the summer breeding season. But we have shorebirds and even some warblers starting to move south in mid to late July.
Wow.
And of course, it occurs in right on through to the end of the year, really.
Yeah, really, right. Still doing it in December?
Some.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some.
But that's also kind of the stable period. That's when we do Christmas bird counts.
Yeah.
Because we feel that's the most stable time. There's not a lot of bird movement in late December.
As you think about this year's migration, has it been, is it unusual, usual, pretty much standard fare so far?
Well, I think every year brings the exceptions, which keeps it exciting for the bird watchers. But, you know, outside of those, I guess the odd ones, it seems to be pretty much on schedule. And I think for the most part, most birds tend to stay on schedule as well.
Yeah. I was kind of wondering about, some unusual or sightings of vagrants. There are usually some birds that go off course and... For some reason, we spot them here kind of unexpectedly. Noel, have you seen anything? Or
in the last week, we've had two western species show up in the state, or at least three, I guess. There's a lark bunting at the Mead Wildlife Center, there at the Nature Center. A week ago, we had a western kingbird in Ozaukee County, which is, we may get one or two, three a year at the most. And then the most excitement, I guess, was over the weekend again, when we had a white-tailed kite show up at Leola Marsh up in Adams County. And there were people.
That's very rare.
That's very rare. We get maybe one every few years.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. Did you get to see any of them?
I didn't travel out to see them. I was in Ohio for the kingbird. But that was about 240 species on this property in northeastern Ozaukee County that we've had in 3 years. So
wow. Wow.
It's been exciting.
You know, it's just incredible that birds know how and when to move on. And the cue, they've got to have a bunch of cues. Is it daylight or sunlight or what is it, Bill?
Yeah, that's the main thing is the shortening days. And everybody would know that by now, if you're getting out of a day job, there isn't much daylight left anymore. And so our longest day, of course, is around the 21st of June. After a month or so from there, as we're already getting into July, we ourselves will start to notice those shortening days. So that's the original trigger for birds to prepare for migration. The actual days they go has to do with the weather systems. So when the cold fronts are coming through in fall and the winds shift from the north, they're going to ride out. So the day length gives them the rough time of the year for the birds, and then the actual day is when the weather's right and the wind's blowing in their direction. But the real driver for migration is food. And I've made this point many times in the past that we hear so commonly at this time of year, people say, well, you know, it's getting cold out and the birds have to go south. It's not the cold itself, but the cold brings that frost, snow, and ice that one way or another eliminates the food supply. So the birds have to anticipate that. They can't wait until the food's gone and then decide to leave.
Oh.
So they've got to anticipate sort of that average, and especially for our insect eaters, you've got to be heading out before we get that first killing frost. So nature's trained them. You never know quite, like any gardener, when that's going to happen. You better be on your way before that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, our guests today, as we talk about fall migration of our birds. It's great to have them with us. Thank you for listening in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Colleen from Plain, Wisconsin, would appreciate a recommendation for a smartphone app that would help her ID bird calls when she's out in the field. And Bill Volker, do you want to take a crack at that?
Yes, you can search around a little bit for some of these. Cornell Laboratories, they've got the Laboratory of Ornithology Sounds, or Animal Sounds, birds and other animals. So they've got a huge library and are making some of those available in different media. I guess you also have to watch a little bit for what kind of phone you have or what's compatible. Audubon also has some that are out there. So if you just do a search between Cornell, Audubon, and a few others, you should be able to find something that both contains a lot of those bird songs in a format that'll work for you.
Got a Facebook comment from Carl Schwartz, who is a state bird city coordinator. He said, I think it's great Bill and Noel are on today to talk about fall migration. All the focus often is on the spring migration, and fall can be just as great a time to enjoy our neotropical migrants. It's one of the things that Bird City, Wisconsin is encouraging its communities to do as they meet their annual requirement to celebrate International Migratory Bird Day. And Carl says, I hope Bill and Noel can talk about encouraging those events.
Absolutely. We used to really celebrate International Migratory Bird Day in May, but we realize there's bird movements going on just about any time of year, as we talked earlier. And fall is a beautiful time. It's not as people don't seem to be quite as busy with other things in September and October as they are in May when it comes to birds.
Yeah.
So it's a good time to hold events. And I know Carl's attended a couple of these events in recent days and given talks and trying to encourage. And Bird City has been a wonderful way to try to recruit people to appreciate birds, learn about birds, get their communities involved in trying to make their communities a better place for birds and people.
Yeah.
Because you said earlier, people like birds.
Yeah.
And if you have a lot of them, people are going to enjoy being there, whether it's working there, living there, vacationing there, whatever it may be.
Yep, because if there's a lot of birds there, there's the habitat and the right conditions that they enjoy, you're going to enjoy them too.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. Mark in Watertown, thanks a lot for calling. Hi.
Hi. Just out of curiosity, my kids and I were out walking around in our backyard. We live out in Watertown, obviously. And we noticed a sandhill crane with a circle pine called flying.
It's probably looking to join a flock. Sandhill cranes, they won't mature and mate until they're about 4 or 5 years old. So you have a number of immatures. And sounds to me like perhaps a young from the previous year or even one from this year somehow got separated from a family looking to join a flock. Normally our migration and big movements of sandhills begin in mid to late October and through November. You'll see a lot of them even around Thanksgiving is when they're really moving out. So a couple of those cold fronts over the next, say, 3-4 weeks, we'll start to see them moving. This one, I'm assuming, was using the thermals, using that rising warm air to get altitude, and probably just looking for other cranes to stage with. So in migration, we really have this flocking behavior of birds, which is sort of preparation for migration as well as the actual movement. So right now, say, central Wisconsin, lots of cranes are going to start flocking up. They're not really moving, so to speak, but these are birds from around the area that are starting to move toward favored feeding sites, and this is where the flocks form, and then when the time is right, they will pick up. rise up on those thermals and then take those upper winds and fly out to the next destination.
It's pretty interesting. Actually, Mark, we were coming into Watertown on A, I believe, on the west side of town, and in one of the fields there were at least 20 sandhills.
Yeah, they stand out there a lot. There's constantly piles and piles of them walking around out there, and the kids are obsessed with them. They love the way they sound. They go running outside when they hear them coming over, and that's why they got really concerned when that one was all by itself, and my little five-year-old asked me, Dad, can you go get it with the plane?
Oh, that's a great story. Well, there were at least 20.
And those flocks will continue to grow now through the fall as they start to bunch up and more of them find each other. And as I say, this is preparation for the eventual migration.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah. And there's a lot of food out there right now with the waste grain through the fall, all the grasshoppers that are out there, good frog population. So there's plenty of food on the landscape for cranes.
Thanks again, Mark. Appreciate the call. By the way, you can join in, too. If you have a question or comment for our guests today, Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Of course, you can email at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. By the way, Judith just posted a link on our Facebook page to a radar that shows migrating birds.
Yeah, I was happy she did that because I was going to try to suggest that we do something like that for today's program. Birds show up on radar. Big dragonflies will show up. Bats will show up. And there's a number.
And they're so prevalent. They're just all over. And we were wondering, do they get stung?
With a hummingbird? No, okay.
Yeah.
All right, thanks. Good questions. Noel, what do you think?
Well, I'll take the last one first about bees and hummingbirds. They definitely, when you get numbers of yellow jackets or bald-faced hornets around your nectar feeders, your hummingbird feeders, there's a lot of interaction, and they'll chase each other a little bit, but I've never actually seen one be stung. I'm sure in a rare occasion it might, if the bee feels trapped or something like that, it may react. But for the most part, I don't think there's really any stinging interaction between hummingbirds and bees.
I would think that hummingbirds' reflexes are just so fast. Those guys are on hyperdrive. I'd imagine that they don't ever get quite that close or give them an opportunity.
No. Nope. There you go. Thanks, Jer. And the other question was about sparrows in Florida.
Well, there are sparrows down there, but some of them are different than our sparrows. A lot of our sparrows that breed here would not breed down in that far south.
If you have a question about birds or maybe an experience to share, or maybe you've got a photo of a bird, you can't figure out what that bird is, well, got the experts for you today, Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, our naturalist. Bill Noel's past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Bill's been a naturalist, a wildlife educator. He was at Horicon Mars forever, a long, long time. So great to have them here with us today to talk about birds and fall migration. The number 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post photo, question, a comment there. And Eric in Madison, you know what? We're going to go to Ann instead. Eric, we'll get to you in just a minute. Ann in Green Bay, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning. I have enjoyed very much the flock of pelicans that have been near the Leo Frigo Bridge, which is now closed, all summer, wondering if they're a migratory bird or if an eagle, bald eagle that I'm now seeing, has scared them away.
Noel, let's go to you.
Well, it's pretty tough to find food for pelicans here in the wintertime, so they're definitely migratory. Even though it seems like we do have one or two that stick around all winter up in the Green Bay area, maybe they're injured or just not capable of a sustained flight, or maybe they have some illness or something. So there's always one or two that we get on Christmas counts in the Green Bay area. But pelicans are definitely migratory, and there should be no interaction with eagles and pelicans to cause them to move. We're seeing more eagles right now because we're just right through the breeding season, and we figure the number of eagles we have in the state, if each one of those brought off another youngster or two, we're doubled or tripled our population from what it was this spring in the state. So you definitely see more eagles and more birds in general in the fall. We don't notice them a lot of times because they're not singing. Mm. They're not as brightly plumaged, but total number of birds, we have more in the fall than we do in the springtime.
Very cool. Thanks, Ann.
Okay. I'll enjoy them both. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Go to it, Ann.
Eric in Madison, give you a chance next. Eric, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to put my 2 cents in about a previous caller had asked about an app for your phone for identifying bird calls. Sibley's actually has an app for both iPhone and Android phones that I find just extremely useful. And it's got bird calls from different parts of the country, and so it's really a great app. I mean, it was about $30, which is a little bit pricier than the free apps that I'm used to getting, but
yeah.
It's definitely been worth it for me, and so I just wanted to throw that recommendation out there for anyone looking for a good bird call app, as well as full descriptions, home ranges, and everything. It's really a great app.
So you think it's worth the $30?
I would agree with you, Eric. I don't have a smartphone, so I don't own an app of any kind. But a lot of my friends do, and I've heard them compliment very favorably the Sibley, David Sibley, Sibley, app to identify bird songs.
Mm-hmm. And with the electronic media these days, it's just amazing how much you can pack into such a portable device.
Yeah.
As you mentioned, you've got the pictures, range maps, life history information, and then the auditory sounds as well.
Yeah.
So it's a lot to carry with you. It's great.
And I do want to say one more thing, too,
sure.
Or maybe you can comment on that. I had come across some comments a while ago about using these type of apps that have bird calls during breeding season and how that could possibly disrupt or cause stress amongst the birds if you're playing it outside, trying to get birds to come in. I mean, as far as territoriality and things like that. I wonder if you'd comment on that a little bit, too, because I think there should be a little bit of a cautionary use for some of these, bird calls that are on your phone that you can just play out when you're hiking a trail or whatever.
I would agree with you, Eric, especially for species that are uncommon or rare or endangered or in public places where you have a lot of people going to. You know, if it's on your own property and you play a song once of a bird, it's probably not going to cause any kind of undue stress. But for some of the rare birds and for these places where you have a lot of people going and they keep hearing a bird recording time after time after time, it can definitely cause some upsets in their normal behavior.
The classic story was one of the first places to actually ban this was Portal in Arizona. It's a birding hotspot on the edge of the desert. It's a little oasis. And it's also far north edge of some of these Mexican birds that will actually nest there, including elegant trogon.
Perfect.
And yeah, people are just moving into there to get a sight for this and actually see one. So many people were going in there and, what can it hurt if I just play this call and bring it out so I can actually see it? Well, every day after day, and some of these birds apparently were failing to breed, were just mobbed by this competition that they thought was out there. And so they eventually banned it. And I guess it's not only a worthy cautionary note here to be a little careful with it, but where the word has gotten out among the avid bird watchers is sort of an ethic. Now these apps are available to everyone, so I guess mm-hmm. we have to have that little bit of a caution for everybody who may download it. Yeah, use it with discretion.
Yep. Thanks again, Eric, for calling. Appreciate it. Margie in McGregor, Iowa. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you very much. I just picked up the Prairie du Chien newspaper and see that it's Hawk Watch weekend at Effigy Mounds National Monument, and I think that would be worth mentioning on your program. They start out with a film on Saturday morning at 9 o'clock of Neil Rettig's American Eagle, which is just fantastic, I think. And then it goes through the whole day with all kinds of different birding events, peregrine falcons, life of raptors. John Stravers does a demonstration on monitoring the birds, and he is one who bans birds, and then they show up in Mexico, and it's just so cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day, on Sunday, we have owls and birds of prey and ospreys in Iowa.
Wow.
So, yeah.
It's this coming weekend.
Yep, that's right. And it starts at 9 o'clock on Saturday, 9:30 on Sunday at Effigy Mounds National Monument. And it's the annual event. It's gone on for 29 years.
Yeah, birds like to use the Mississippi River as a corridor for migration. So this is on the bluffs on the Iowa side. So it's a It's a wonderful place to watch migrating raptors. So thanks for calling that in, Margie.
Thank you very much, Margie. Appreciate it. And the Mississippi River, that's one of the really great hotspots to watch for migrating birds. What are some other ones?
Well, a lot of the waterfall will stage there. And so you've got big breeding populations of ducks in the Dakotas and south central Canada, what we call the Prairie Pothole Region, or what the waterfowl managers have called the duck factory of North America. Mm-hmm. Some of these birds, like canvasbacks, are heading toward Chesapeake Bay. Others are going down toward the Gulf Coast in the southern states. Well, this is a big stopover point and feeding area for them. And it's also a big stopover for the tundra swans that are nesting up in Alaska and heading to Chesapeake Bay as they cut across the entire continent. So you've either got birds like the hawks that are using this as a main highway, as a north-south corridor, or as a stopover point from birds that are crisscrossing across the continent as a major feeding area. You've got a lot of the aquatic vegetation in those backwaters, and that is really just a smorgasbord for these birds and a traditional stopover for a lot of those.
Yeah, great places to go and see in Horicon Marsh and Lake. It's just wonderful. That's my favorite. I love to go to Horicon Marsh.
Absolutely.
And if you're looking for a place to go birding, there's just so many places this time of year. Any kind of natural area or park, here in the Madison area, if you want to go see warblers, a traditional spot is kind of go to Pheasant Branch Conservancy out in Middleton. But you have Cherokee Marsh, and you just have numerous parks and natural areas here in the Madison area. But that holds true for the entire state. So
yep, absolutely.
There's no shortage of places to go to find birds this time of year.
Tim in Madison, thanks for calling. Hi, what's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call, and I really appreciate the show. I had a question about warblers. I'm new to birding, and I've only been doing it for about a year. And with the migration coming up, I got excited about going out and trying to see some warblers, but I'm not entirely sure where to look. I'm not really having a lot of good luck. So I go out to, I was at Wildcat Mountain State Park. I was out at the Arboretum, and I was pretty good at finding other things, but not exactly sure where to look for warblers.
Yeah. All right. Let's hear from Bill.
Well, my first hint is to start in spring.
Yeah.
Warblers are a very confusing group. They're tiny, very active birds, a lot of them in the middle and upper part of the trees as they're moving through, and about 35 species known to Wisconsin. So they can be challenging. In springtime, the leaves are just beginning to emerge when they're coming. The males are all in their brilliant plumage, and they're a little easier to sort out. For fall time, we're getting toward the latter end now of that migration. A lot of our warblers are moving in August and into that early to mid part of September. So now they're moving under the real cover of all the dense foliage. They're up in those treetops, and when you've got maple and oak leaves full size, the birds are not actively singing, but they are feeding. And you got a little 4-inch bird in a canopy of a tree, and they no longer have those brilliant spring colors for most of them. You've got the young ones that won't have their bright colors till next spring. The adult males are shedding those feathers and growing into a winter plumage, which is more dull, and some of them can be incredibly challenging. Plus, it's hard to find them. So you're a little past the real peak. Yellow rump warblers are just starting to show up, but they're always out of sequence with everyone else. They come a little late and arrive early in spring compared to the main peak.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as places to watch, any good woodlot, especially in August, September, get out there where the trees are abundant and just start walking around and watching.
Yeah.
There's still a few hanging around, though, at this point.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. I remember we did a little birding walk in spring at Picnic Point, and the woods are around that area. I saw quite a few warblers.
On a good day, the woods can be just alive with them.
Actually, it was on Mother's Day. That's right.
There you go.
Mother's Day, Judith reminds me.
The peak of the migration for them in spring.
Oh, yeah, lots of warblers.
But you'll also see in field guides, by the way, they oftentimes will lump separately what they call, and many of them will refer to them just as that confusing fall warblers. And, yeah, they can be challenging.
Lorna and Elgin, Illinois. Lorna, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had two questions, really. One is that it looks like, well, we have a little renter in our birdhouse. She moved in about 3 days ago, and it looks like a black-capped chickadee, but I'm not sure. And I'm just wondering, are they one of the kind of birds that have more than one brood per year, and is it possible that that's what it could be? And the other question I have is, we have a lot of hawks and peregrine falcons around here, and they're kind of competing with the bald-headed eagles that we have in the area. And I'm wondering, do the hawks and eagles compete for the smaller animals like the squirrels and the chipmunks?
All right. Well, you want to...
The chickadees that are going into your box now are probably just roosting there overnight. This is considerably past their breeding season, so they would not be breeding. They may have a couple of broods during the year. I can't recall offhand whether that's true or not.
One, sometimes two broods, depending on how early the start they get.
But it's way past their breeding season, so they're roosting there, and he may stay there every night for a while, maybe find a better place and move out. So enjoy it while you can, I guess. And as far as raptors competing, we have certain raptors that feed more on squirrels and chipmunks, for example, and then we have other species that feed more on birds. Eagles are not going to take either one of those to any great degree. Maybe a duck out on a pond of water that's injured or can't forage for itself, or maybe a coot. But eagles are not big bird predators, and they're certainly not small mammal predators either. The birds that you're going to see in a more urban environment, for the most part, that are going to be primarily a bird predator are Cooper's hawks. And you're probably seeing those more than you are peregrine falcons. They're still quite uncommon. You might have one pair of peregrines around and maybe a few migrating through. But Cooper's hawks, I say in the Milwaukee area, there's a pair of Cooper's hawks that nest in every park in Milwaukee anymore.
That's great. Thanks, Lorna, for calling. Appreciate your call. Back to the comment about apps. Caller Pedro in Fond du Lac had a good point. He said you could use headphones or, your little buds, earbuds, when you're using the bird app, so you don't have to worry about upsetting the birds and you can still hear.
That's a great hint that way. Or just have the volume low enough so that you can use it for reference rather than turning it up, pointing it out in the direction of the bird, and kind of broadcasting it. Yeah. And, these are all references for us. Just like you use your field guide as a visual reference. I've always told people, don't expect that you're just going to play those and go to sleep and know all the birds in the morning. But it's something that you can help to brush up for and get a little more familiar and help to double check a few things that you might suspect what you're hearing.
We had this talk about birdhouses. That's kind of a sad email from Bob in Madison, who says, when I was cleaning out the Purple Martin houses this past weekend, there were 8 dead martins that were almost fully grown. That was many more than I usually see when I'm cleaning out all the houses. Any ideas about what might cause? Was there any special disease?
There seemed to be an unusual number of large die-offs of martins that were almost ready to fledge, as he mentions. We're not quite sure, but it's probably food-related. They probably died of starvation during some of those cool periods. They just couldn't get enough food.
Too bad.
I don't think there's any disease or parasites or anything like that that's really bothering them.
No, nothing I'm familiar with. The other possibility is that maybe the adults were killed. I remember a number of years ago, we had the Martin houses at Horicon, and unfortunately a large oak tree was close enough that the Cooper's hawk could ambush them.
Oh.
And so we had to move the houses back a little more, so make it a little more difficult. And if you happen to take out the adults for those young, nobody's feeding them. Yeah. Again, we can't be conclusive, but food shortages or the loss of the adults are likely the case.
An email from Mary, who says, my family and I were walking in the Navarino Wildlife Area in southern Shawano and northeast Waupaca counties last weekend. They heard a bird they'd never heard before. Call was very loud, 3 distinct descending notes followed by a longer continuous descending note. So we thought it sounded like a rusty gate being closed.
Rusty blackbird.
We caught a fleeting look at the bird flying into the trees. It was about the size of a blue jay or a woodpecker or a bigger woodpecker. We didn't see any markings or color. It looks similar We looked for similar sounds online, but couldn't find any.
I would say, especially if it was in a woody area that's a little wet, it'd be a rusty blackbird. This is a bird that only breeds, I think during the Breeding Bird Atlas, we only had them breeding up in the Apostle Islands. So they're really boreal breeders, but they migrate this time of year, and I've seen several here in the last week. And when you say the squeaky or rusty closing gate, that is the perfect apt description for the sound that a rusty blackbird makes.
Yeah, very typical. You'll hear a two or three note, and I usually, in my mind, I describe it as squeaky or squeakily. It's got that sort of a rolling two or three note, and it'll gather up in the tops of those trees, usually on the edge of wetlands.
Very good. So there you have it. Thank you very much for that email question. Joy and Madison, your turn. Hi, Joy.
Hi. I'm hoping you can help me ID a bird. I used to bird a lot some decades ago, but when I had this sighting, my skills were pretty rusty. I was working my garden in the fall and heard some birds go over and looked up, and there were three altitudes flying all at the same time. In the highest layer of birds, there was a very large bird that had deeply back-swept wings as though it had elbows, and the elbows were kind of akimbo. And it was all cinnamon-colored underneath, and it was flanked by smaller large birds, not being chased, just flanked. Does that ring a bell? Those deeply back-swept wings seemed unusual to me.
Was it soaring?
Was it soaring? I believe it was soaring, and the ones that were accompanying it were flapping.
Well, until you threw the word cinnamon in there, I was going to suggest turkey vulture. But
I know turkey vultures. I mean, I've never seen one that had this deeply bent wing, back swept bent wing. I mean, not that I've personally seen. You know, it looked as if you had your arms out to your shoulders and then turned your forearms down. The bottom part of the wing paralleled the body.
Bill and I are here looking at each other and shaking our head.
Well, real long neck or beak to it by chance?
I'm sorry, say again?
A long neck or beak? Or a little more stocky?
Long neck. No, it was up pretty high. I couldn't see if it had a... No long neck. No, it wasn't like a heron-type neck or anything like that. No, it was like a hawk-type thing, but it seemed at the time much bigger to me.
Wouldn't be an osprey, I don't think. You know, ospreys have crooked wings, but they get quite a bit of white on them.
Oh, no. Okay, I could look in dig out my book and look at osprey, but I was shocked at the time because it did not look familiar at all to me. And it seemed, I guess I got the feeling it had come from a long way away, and it was this kind of alien.
Well, there is always that possibility of something way off track. I mean, just reaching for things, it could even be Anhinga. We've had a few records up here. There's a lot of possibilities, and it doesn't mean that it isn't even a rare sighting for the whole state. But we're not coming up with anything right off the top here.
Okay. I've seen Anhingas sitting on logs. I've never seen them up in the sky, of course. But I'll look at ospreys and look at some further field things. And great, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks
Good
a lot
luck.
For calling. Very important note about the caller that called about the Hawk Watch event at the Effigy Mounds National Monument. If the government shutdown is not resolved by this weekend...
Oh, yeah, it's a national monument.
The site will not be open. This is the info on the site when you go to it. Because of the federal government shutdown, all national parks are closed, and National Park Service web pages are not operating.
There's a lot of good bluffs along the Mississippi. I'll have to find another one that's a little more accessible so you can get up there and really watch the traffic that's coming down that Mississippi corridor.
Yep.
That's what makes Effigy Mounds so nice. It's easily developed for people, and it gives you that access to those middle and upper bluffs so you can really look out and enjoy everything.
Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, our guests today as we talk the fall migration here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network as we talk about the fall migration with Bill Volkert, naturalist, retired wildlife educator at Horicon Marsh International Education Center, and Noel Cutright, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Wonderful to have them with us. Thank you for listening in. questions, call us at 800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page. You can post a question or photo there at the Larry Mueller Show. Dean in Redcliffe has a question. Hi, Dean. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was curious about smaller birds that would be migrating from Canada, northern Minnesota, and Wisconsin across Lake Superior. What would be the would they be more likely to follow the land, or do they take hops from, say, the Canadian border across the length of the open water of Lake Superior to the south shore of it? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. All right, thank you. Noel, you want to take that? Noel Cartwright?
Yeah, most of our smaller songbirds do migrate at night, and it's pretty much in a broad front once they get airborne. So they'll fly all the way across Lake Superior with no problems. And then when daylight hits, hopefully they've made it to the south shore or to our north shore in the Ashland-Bayfield area, maybe over in the UP. And they'll head down to restoke their energy supply during the day. But they don't really follow any pathway, but migrating across broad expanses of water. I mean, after all, some of these birds are heading for the tropics, and they're going to migrate all the way across the Gulf of Mexico without stopping. So Lake Superior is pretty easy for them. And you could even see this in Lake Michigan. A bird will be migrating, say, the length of Lake Michigan. Daylight hits, they look down and say, uh-oh, there's water down there. Mm-hmm. I need to get on shore. And they'll make almost a right-angle turn and head either for the Michigan shore or for the Wisconsin shore. A lot of times depends on whether one of those shores are in eyesight. May also depend on what the wind direction is. But they do want to hit land once it gets to be daylight. And just this last weekend, Ryan Brady, who lives in Bayfield, not far from the shore, they recorded thousands of birds coming in off the lake, at 7:30, 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning, and just hitting the treetops like crazy.
Ah, very cool.
Well, for the birds who are flying over open water, you've got more steady winds. You don't have the turbulence. You don't have differential warming of the water surface like you do on the land. You don't have trees and buildings which create these updrafts. So you get a nice north wind. It's a steady, calm, even breeze for them. And if you're flying at night, that's right to your back, and you can just shoot right across it. And for a bird to cover, 150 miles maybe at some of the widest there, that's not a big deal for them.
At all. Oh, wonderful. Jerry in Milwaukee, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hi. This is a little off the migration topic, but I think it's a good bird question. What is the latest information on sightings of the ivory-billed woodpecker? A few years ago, that was in the paper. Different opinions whether it was a actual sighting or not, but I'd like to get the expert's opinion on this.
Mm-hmm. Well, for recent update, I guess in one word, nothing.
It's a dead issue.
Yeah.
They did a search that was just unbelievable, trying to verify what looked like a really good sighting back in the early 2000s. They had quite a strategy for 2 or 3 years and have never come up with anything conclusive since. And after those searches, what was about 2009 or so, when those were starting to wind down, we really haven't heard anything. And I think people have just kind of given up. And whether they're out there or not, we cannot verify if they still exist. And it sounded really tempting. People were just on this thing like crazy, and we could never stir anything up to verify that they're really out there. So that's probably why you haven't heard anything. Nobody has turned anything up since then.
One of the great bird carvers, I think, of all time is Bob Googie, and I am fortunate enough to have several of Bob's carvings, and one is of an ivory-billed woodpecker.
Oh, wonderful.
And I also have a red-headed woodpecker but I also have a pileated or pileated woodpecker, and the two kind of side by side make for an interesting comparison.
Absolutely.
I really feel fortunate to have those.
Well, you should be, and I'd hang on to them because that might be the only ivory bill you'll ever see.
People say, "What is those? Are those both pileated?" No, they don't look the same. No, that's an ivory bill.
Well, with our designation of an extinct species, sort of rule of thumb, they normally give about 50 years after the last confirmed sighting. And there were two sightings, one in Louisiana back about 12 years ago or 15 years ago, and then this one in the Mississippi River bottoms, which the big search was on. Those were intriguing. We kind of took it off the endangered list, saying, well, or the extinct list, I should say. Maybe they're still out there. Maybe there's a few, but we have not been able to verify it.
Yeah,
they may just
really
be gone.
Too bad. Yeah, really too bad. Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you. Great program.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. I should post a photo of those.
That'd be nice.
Photo of my ivory bill and my
Affiliated
and put those up on my Facebook page. I'll do that.
I got a feeling it's about as likely right now to find an ivory bill as is Bigfoot.
Right. Gloria in Brookfield. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. My husband and I are avid birders, and we attract a lot of birds to our backyard. And recently, I would say within the past three weeks or so, we've had a very unusual sighting of a very small hummingbird that's been feeding on impatiens and other flowers that we have in our front yard. I've never seen this particular species before. I have looked at some of my Wisconsin bird watching books and some of my Birds of North America Smithsonian books, and I just haven't been able to find this one. It's extremely small. It's probably only about a half an inch to three-fourths of an inch long in the body, and it has a very thin, needle-like beak. The stripes on it are very much like a wasp or a bee, like a black and yellow, and it's not a shy hummingbird. Some hummingbirds are very shy, and this one is okay if you're standing there and watching it as it goes from flower to flower.
Yeah,
and its wing spread is the colors on it on the wing. It has like a black edging, and in the middle of the wings, it looks orange, almost like a monarch butterfly.
Yep. We've got it
nailed, Gloria.
We can help you on this one.
Yeah. So, absolutely. No. Neil, no?
It's not a hummingbird, Gloria.
It's not.
It's not. It's a sphinx moth.
It's a moth.
P-H-I-N-X. Is that right?
S-P-H, is it?
S-P-H.
Sphinx moth.
Sphinx moth. They're also called hummingbird moths. And there's been an explosion of the white-lined sphinx moths this fall. They've been more abundant than I can ever remember.
Yeah, we have them in, our bed, our kind of flower bed up front. We've had all kinds of them, actually.
Yeah, there's a number of different species. They're very brightly colored. They have this very long proboscis or tongue that looks a bit like a beak, and they will hover and feed on flowers just like hummingbirds do. Commonly confused.
Wow. And can you spell that for me?
S-P-H-I-N-X. Sphinx moth.
Sphinx moth.
Yep.
Okay.
And a number of different species under that.
Well, thank you very much. I have never seen anything like it.
Well, now you know. You go online, just type in sphinx moth, or if you got even some of the bird books will have sphinx moth in next to the hummingbirds.
Because they're so easily confused.
Yeah, because they're so easily confused.
Couldn't find it in any of my books, so now I learned something.
Well,
thank
good.
You so much.
That's why we're here, Gloria.
That's exactly right. Oh, we had an email from Donna DePere, enjoys watching birds, and was reading that during the winter months, birds might be attracted to a place to roost and stay warm during the winter months. Is this something I could build for birds? Where would I find plans to build something like that, and what breed of birds might I attract a structure like that? And is it a desirable thing to do, actually?
The cavity nesting birds will sometimes use a roost hole in the wintertime. So it's nothing special that you can build for them other than just have bird houses out there on the landscape. You know, some people like to plug their houses or even take them down in the winter. I always like to leave them up because you never know when something like a chickadee or a woodpecker wants to roost in at night. But there's no special plans or anything for them.
All right.
The one problem with the birdhouses is that a lot of them would lack the insulation that a good natural cavity would.
Yeah.
You will sometimes find early spring and occasionally into the early mid-fall where the bluebirds or tree swallows may gather in those, in a number of them,
yeah.
and they kind of warm each other as just in preparation for migration. Oftentimes, say, wood duck boxes, a nice place for screech owls to hang out, but that's just circumstance. So put out something for nesting and otherwise see what happens. The other thing would be, of course, good dense shelter from plant cover. Your conifers, your dense shrubs, those can provide some thermal shelter and hiding places for birds. That works very well for winter shelter.
Don in Portage. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi there. See, I just tuned in a while ago, but I heard you talking about things being off track. I have an example of that. This summer, I saw a western tanager. I live in Portage.
You live in, saw it in Portage, huh?
Yeah, and I can tell you that it was only about 4 or 5 feet from me as I looked out my window onto my railing, and once you see one, you'll never mistake it.
Yeah. Noel?
That's really a good sighting. And there have been a few seen in Wisconsin this year, but usually western tanagers may be a handful in the state every year. So you feel fortunate you were able to see one and be able to identify it.
Very yeah, cool.
Went on the prime list. See, I wanted to ask you, talking about purple martins a while ago. What is the status of purple martins? When we were kids, they were all over the place.
That's yeah. right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They've declined about as much as any bird in Wisconsin, maybe as much as 90% over the last several decades. In many parts of their range throughout eastern and western U.S., the populations are hanging in there pretty well, but in the states of Iowa, Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, and up into Ontario, they have significantly declined, and we really don't understand why they should be declining in those areas and not declining in, say, similar northern areas in the northeast or farther south or in Ohio, Kentucky areas where they seem to be doing just fine.
Hmm.
So where would be an area in Wisconsin you might find one?
Well, they're still around. They breed in probably every county in the state. But all the colonies are abandoned, and you certainly see more empty houses than you do houses with martins in them these days.
Yeah. And talking about other birds, rare birds, Jill sent a Facebook note in and said she thinks she saw a great egret sitting in a tree near Dorothy Carnes Park in Fort Atkinson on Sunday. Did they make it to Wisconsin?
Oh, yes. This fall, there's been good numbers. There's been a drawdown in Buffalo Lake and Montello Lake up in, what county is that, Wautoma County?
Marquette
County. There has been an estimated as many as 1,000 great egrets in
wow.
these drawn-down areas. And I know Horicon also gets some really nice concentrations of in the fall.
We're at the northern edge of the nesting range for the bird, and in Wisconsin it is listed as a threatened species, so they just barely get this far north, but we do have a number of colonies where the birds actively nest in mostly the southern half of the state and along the Mississippi River. And at this time of year, as they're getting ready for migration, they now leave those nesting sites and gather at favored feeding areas.
Okay.
So as Noel mentioned, the water's going down, fish and frogs are getting stranded, it's easy pickings, and these things can concentrate in some really large numbers. And of course, Fort Atkinson, you're right down the Rock River from Horicon. They're probably slowly making their way south. So,
yep,
enjoy them while they're here. They'll be moving out shortly.
And just a Facebook comment from Barbara a few weeks ago. We were talking earlier about hummingbirds and bees kind of all after the feeders. She said, I watched a hummingbird go after one of those pesky bees. So it appears these little winged creatures do not fear the bees very much. They'll go right. after them. There we go. Well, I tell you what, we're having fun today talking with Bill Volker, naturalist, and naturalist Noel Cutright as well, past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, about the fall migration and our birds. Great to have them along, and they're going to be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and news is next. Well, whether we know almost nothing about them or we've studied them our whole lives, birds are fascinating, aren't they? They add to our enjoyment of Wisconsin's great natural areas, not just by sight, but by sound as well. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. And also great to have our two guests. Bill Volker, I've been watching and studying birds for 40 years. He spent 27 years as a naturalist at Horicon Marsh. And, Bill, thanks again for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Always my pleasure.
And Bill Volkert, who has been watching and studying birds for even longer, and he's past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. And great to have you with me in the studio, Noel.
Thanks, Larry.
Really appreciate both these guys being here today. And thank you for listening in, too. Lots of callers, lots of questions. We have some really interesting Facebook photos. One from Deb with a shot of a... You should really go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show to see this. She said, this eagle grabbed a red squirrel off my feeder and landed on the maple tree in my yard. Gives new meaning to bird feeders. And there she's got a photo of the eagle holding on to the red squirrel.
Great.
I would think that's maybe fox squirrel.
Probably a fox squirrel. Yeah, it looks a little large. Okay.
But, you know, it's not their normal fare, but, you know, birds are opportunists. So normally fish is the primary food for eagles, but they'll take what they can get and even scavenge on roadkills.
And John sent a couple of photos and says, this bird is protecting my yard, much to the dismay of my wife. What do you think?
Redtail on the left.
Yeah, it looks like a young redtail on the left and Cooper's hawk on the right.
On the right, yep. Two different birds for sure. And there's another great... bald eagle shot from Rob. He was shooting some photos in a Madison park. And, you know, he says, imagine my surprise when an eagle landed and I discovered two of them in my viewfinder.
Great.
Unfortunately, they always faced away from me. So this was my best shot of them together. He's sort of looking at their backs. But right here in Madison.
This is the time of year they're moving around and you never know what will show up where.
And we actually there's a nesting pair in Madison. So
okay.
We've got them in every county in the state. And a few years ago already, we surpassed 1,500 nesting pair of bald eagles in Wisconsin.
Isn't that wonderful?
So yeah, they have been really come back in this state in particular.
So let's go to Wend in Sandusky, Ohio next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Good. My question is about whippoorwills. I go to Canada twice a year for the last 15 years up in the McGregor-Iroquois Bay area, and I always hear whippoorwills every evening. And I've lived in Ohio for 50-plus years, and I've only heard them once, and that was this spring. I just wondered how far south they come, and also, they come down into Wisconsin.
Yeah. Used to have a lot of them.
Yeah, we used to have a lot of them, Wend, and you can find them all the way down into Florida and Texas. So, Wisconsin used to be a good stronghold for them, but the population's declined so. We don't understand why. They're a neotropical migrant, meaning that they migrate all the way to the tropics for the wintertime. But we don't know whether it's something happening there during their migratory journey, whether it's happening here on the breeding grounds. But all of the Breeding Bird Atlas second projects that we'll be undertaking here in Wisconsin soon have shown a significant decline in the number of whippoorwills, including Ontario. Ontario just completed their second Breeding Bird Atlas in the last year or so, and they saw a stark contrast in the numbers between their first and second atlas. So Sandusky is not, you don't have a lot of extensive woodlands there, but I grew up in the southern part of Ohio, and we used to have 3 to 4 whippoorwills perched on our house every night.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you.
So they have declined and even disappeared from many places in the Midwest and even in Ontario. At least it seems as if the population started retreating. And even there, it certainly, as Noel indicated, has gone down some. And some places like Wisconsin, we've lost them entirely from sections of the state. Still in the southwestern part of the state, we've got a fair population. But there again, we've no longer hear them where we used to.
Yeah, it's really too bad.
Yes,
I really miss that. That sound. Thanks, Wend. Richard in Wisconsin Dells, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great, thanks for calling.
Okay, we have
2 years ago, I have a poplar out in our front yard. I live in the city of Wisconsin Dells, and the poplar started to die up on the top, and I wanted to try to save it, so I had a tree trimmer come in and take off the tops. Well, I had a pileated come over there and drill a hole in on the north side of that underneath the big branch, and they nested in there. Now, I'd like to take the tree down because it doesn't look too good. You know, the bark is coming off and everything else. Now, do they nest year after year in the same hole, or should I leave the tree up because I really enjoy seeing the bird?
Hmm.
Well, I guess it depends on how likely that tree's going to come down in the wrong place. Yeah, they will come back to that same nest hole as long as it's available for them, especially if they've been successful in raising a family there. It worked 1 year. Why not? But if you're going to make your living out of a home in a dead tree, it has a short-term tenure. Those trees will eventually either snap off or rot at the base and come down. So these birds are used to rotating, so to speak, looking for new sites. They're always out on the move. So you're very fortunate you had them nesting right in your backyard and right in town like that. But there's certainly plenty of alternatives out there for the bird if that comes down. You're not, say, totally depriving them of all opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I really enjoy watching them. They had two and one passed away. It didn't make it. The other one did make it. And I was wondering if I would take off the top of that tree so I'm not going to have things falling on the house and the rest of the kind of stuff, that maybe I can take and get them back again, you know, just by topping it down. Would that change? Would that drive them away from there, you think? Or?
I guess you could just try it and see if that'll, you know, if there's homed in enough on that, you know, they'll just try again. Yeah, take the risk. I guess I would look at it from two points of view. One is for the sake of the bird. Yeah, keep the tree as long as you can. If it looks like it's leaning towards your house, you might want to take it down a little sooner than that. So, yeah, if you modify it, it's up to the bird. If he's, you know, finds it that suitable, he may just drill another hole or may just find another site.
If they go ahead and take and nest this next year, that'll be great. And if they don't, then if they're not nesting in there, then I suppose in July or someplace like that, I could take the tree down then, right?
Yeah, sure. Yep, sounds like a plan. You bet that'll work.
Okay, thanks for your giving me some information. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. Tom in Frog Point. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I wanted to mention that I've noticed how blue jays will imitate other birds so much. And a couple of days ago, I was at the backyard, and this blue jay was doing a perfect imitation of a hawk. I think it probably was a Cooper's hawk.
I got to ask you, Tom, where's Frog Point?
Frog Point is south of La Crosse.
Okay. Place I've never heard of before.
Well, it's the population is really high. In springtime, we have a lot of frogs.
That's interesting. So a blue jay can imitate another bird, or will imitate another bird?
Blue jays are wonderful. Bill says he has red-shouldered hawks nesting near him, and they're calling out calls of red-shoulders all the time, and they're somewhat of ventriloquist also sometimes. You don't know where it's coming from, but blue jays love to do that. We don't know whether they're trying to tell their friends and neighbors that there's a raptor around, or whether they're showing off or just having fun.
There we go. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and usually birds of prey is what they'll imitate. Right. Red tail seems to be the most common. I've heard red shoulder, as Noel mentioned, and even up north I heard broadwing imitations. They're pretty darn good at it. The one thing you'll notice, it doesn't have quite that robustness of those bigger birds. So most of the times I can tune in, it's like, that's close, but you're not quite fooling me.
Cynthia and Minocqua, appreciate your call. Hi.
Hi. I had a suggestion for the man that wanted to learn about warblers.
Yeah.
I think it sounded like he was in the Madison area, and I was going to suggest a quick way to start learning them is to go out with a group of people that are knowledgeable already, and there's the Madison Audubon Society in Madison, and I know they have trips going different places. And also I wanted to give a plug for the bird club I'm in. This is up in the North Woods, and Oneida, Vilas, or Eastern Price County, and it's the North Lakeland Discovery Center Bird Club. And we meet on Thursday mornings for a hike to different places. And we are on the website for the North Lakeland Discovery Center. And we have our meetings the first Monday of the month. And the one coming up October 7th is at 6 p.m. And my husband, Jim Krakowski, is going to talk on chimney swifts.
All right.
And on building the chimneys. The artificial chimneys.
Mm-hmm.
We're hoping to do that as a group, a bird club at the Discovery Center, and also Manitowish. That's out of Manitowish Waters, and also have Manitowish Waters, the community, build one also because they are a bird city.
I was going to compliment some of the smaller communities in northern Wisconsin have become bird city communities. So. It's a great way to get your community involved, and chimney swifts are kind of one of my pet birds right now. Most of them have already migrated out of the state, but this last week, a friend of mine, Joan, in Fredonia, Wisconsin, had 602 chimney swifts still going in a chimney to roost at night.
Wow.
So it was quite a sight. So, yeah, your good suggestions. Madison Audubon has a whole suite of field trips. Wisconsin Society for Ornithology holds field trips around the state, and many of the other Audubon societies and bird clubs also have opportunities for people to learn about birds.
Yeah. Well, as we've been mentioning, birds are found everywhere and at almost any time, but there are hot spots where birds are migrating through and certain seasons for the birds. And as we mentioned earlier, with the fall warblers can be challenging a little difficult for people to learn on their own. So, yeah, going out with an organized field trip, people can tell you where to go, when to go, and how to actually start to identify them properly and to know what you're looking at. So, yeah, it's a great way to do it, to share with somebody like that. That's a great way to get started, you bet.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And Judith just noted that the Natural Resources Foundation of Wisconsin has, a couple hundred field trips now, I think, around the state. Mm-hmm. Some of those will be focused on birds. It's kind of late in the fall to sign up, but check their website and try to sign up for some of those field trips next year.
And thanks again for calling. Dave in Appleton, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a question. I've noticed watching geese, they're flying north, or they're flying south now, but I've noticed in the evening one or two, three, four, five small groups. They fly north as the sun is just about ready to get down. They fly north, small groups, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, they're going the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
So does anyone know why geese will fly north, in other words, going the wrong way when they're supposed to be migrating south this time of year, in small groups, not the big ones. The big ones are all going south.
Well, that's a great question. When I was at Horicon, I got this question every single fall. I'd always have people ask me, it's fall, everybody should be going south today, thousands of geese were going north. What was that about? Remember what I said earlier, that there is this preparation for migration and the actual movement. When geese are migrating, they're flying 2,000 to 5,000 feet up and will go as high as 10,000 feet, depending where the winds are. However, when they're going from a roosting site to feeding, they're about 1 to 500 feet up. So what you're seeing really is not birds migrating the wrong way. What they're actually doing is they're just moving from where they were feeding that day to where they're going to roost for the evening. So these are daily movements as they're preparing themselves for what will be an eventual migration and exodus. So no, they're not confused. These are just local movements right now for daytime feeding and coming back to rest.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, it's been a very special day for us here. Noel and Bill are definitely favorites for many of our listeners. They've been so generous. They share every major holiday with us, and they've been doing it for as long as pretty much we can remember here. So it's great to have them on an extra time this fall, and especially because they took the time to come to our studios in Madison today instead of doing it by phone. So it's been a real treat for me, and I hope for all of you as well. And we're going to spend the last few minutes of our show today helping our friends at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources honor Noel for his unflagging devotion to our state's birds. Kurt Thede, who is, hi Kurt, Kurt's the DNR Lands Division Administrator, is joining us in the studio. And Kurt, great to have you with us.
Great. Well, thanks for the invitation. We appreciate it.
And Noel has done a lot
He absolutely has. And so today, Noel, on behalf of the Wisconsin DNR, our citizens and our birders of the state, we just wanted to have an opportunity to say thank you. You've done and given so much in the world of bird conservation here, and what we wanted to do is just take a moment to highlight a few of those amazing accomplishments. During your day job as the senior terrestrial ecologist for nearly 30 years at We Energies, founder of the River Edge Bird Club in 1986, past president twice of the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology, a historian for the WSO, a leader in establishing a Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. You've helped promote the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas and served on the Atlas Steering Committee. Senior editor of the Atlas of Breeding Birds of Wisconsin, published in 2006. Helped to launch the Milwaukee County Avian Migration Monitoring Partnership, which won a 2007 award on citizen-based monitoring from the Department of Natural Resources. A 2007 Lifetime Achievement Award for citizen-based monitoring for over 30-plus years of not only monitoring, but then seeing those actions being implemented as part of bird conservation. Tirelessly promoting and participating in the Federal Breeding Bird Survey for 30-plus years. Christmas Bird Counts. A prestigious Lifetime Achievement Award from Gathering Waters Conservancy in 2010. Receiving the Silver Passenger Pigeon and Green Passenger Pigeon Awards from the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology, and the first annual Laurie Otto Memorial Award from Milwaukee Audubon in 2011. Longtime advisor to us at the DNR and the Fish and Wildlife Service, and also instrumental in creation of Bird City, Wisconsin, and has served on the board of directors. You've also been instrumental in promoting migratory bird conservation and establishing the Western Great Lakes Bird and Bat Observatory with headquarters at Forest Beach Migratory Preserve in Ozaukee County. An amazing list, and I can assure you I've only touched on a few of them. So today, in recognition of your outstanding service, leadership, and commensurate passion for conserving Wisconsin's bird populations and their habitats, on behalf of the Department of Natural Resources, we wanted to present you with this plaque of our appreciation, which I believe has one of your favorite birds on the plaque, the Kentucky Warbler.
And I wonder how you know that, Kurt. Someone did a little fishing here recently, and I said Kentucky Warbler was my favorite, and the plaque you just presented to me, I have a lump in my throat, I got goosebumps on my leg, and this really does mean a lot. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Noel.
It's a wonderful wonderful tribute, and what a beautiful award. We'll get a photo of that, and let's post that up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show so you can see it. It's a beautiful plaque and certainly something that's well-deserved. I'm sure of that, Bill, and you're certainly going to agree with that.
Well, I certainly will. Noel has been a very dear friend of mine for many years, my partner here on these radio shows. I've been so fortunate to share the airwaves with him, and the people of Wisconsin are certainly so much more informed about birds because of the work that Noel has done, and I would have to say that I believe that the birds of Wisconsin are better off because of his contributions to both education of our wildlife resources and certainly the conservation of birds and their habitats in the state. He's really made a mark on this state, and for that, all of the bird watchers, the bird lovers, and the birds themselves are thankful for what Noel has done for us.
Yeah. Thanks, Bill.
Yeah, that is so very true, and Sam Robbins would probably be smiling right now, too.
He probably is.
A little bit.
And between those two, those are certainly some of the great pillars of Wisconsin conservation for bird life in Wisconsin.
We were trying to think before the show, we were doing a little calculating and trying to remember when you were first on the show, Noel, but it's been, got to be 15 years.
Probably.
At least 15 years. And you think of...
It's been long enough none of us can remember.
And our memories are going, for sure. So we think about Memorial Day, the 4th of July...
Labor Day.
Thanksgiving's always
Thanksgiving,
a favorite.
Thanksgiving,
that's a fantastic show.
Favorite. And
New Year's.
And then on to New Year's Day, at least those five.
Yeah, and occasionally a special one here and there.
And a special one here and there. it's really wonderful for you, for the both of you, but for you to take the time out of your holiday.
I wish we had more holidays.
Yeah. You know, I can remember actually interviewing somebody else. This is years back on a Thanksgiving day, and he somebody asked a question. He said, "Oh, wait a minute, I got to baste the turkey." he left his telephone and left me to fill in while he went to baste the turkey, and he came back and then answered.
Just left you hanging.
Kind of left me hanging there. Well, now, you guys have never left me hanging, or Judith. Judith, who has walked into the studio now, too, has done so many of the shows with you. So we were really delighted, Kurt, when you got a hold of us and said, hey, we'd like to do something here on the air.
Well, we wanted to take an opportunity not only just to share this with Noel and you, obviously, but then all of your listeners as well that have gleaned so much information from Noel over the years and from Bill. So, again, just so happy that we were able to make this work today.
I am, too.
Well, thank you. And once again, thanks to Kurt Thede from the Department of Natural Resources, and obviously thanks to Bill Volkert and to Noel Cutright for all of the great work that they have done, and especially Noel, on this special day you're getting this award. It's really been a pleasure for us to have you as a guest, and hopefully we can still continue to have you as a guest if you'll
I hope so.
If you continue to come. Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, our guests, and we hope to have them back on the next holiday here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You stay with us.
Weekends on WPR are fun and informative.
Meow.
What's wrong with that cat?
Just to be clear, that was Bill. That wasn't an actual cat.
No, I know.
Listen on the weekends, right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. See the schedule at WPR.org.
Supporters of WPR include listeners like you. This past year, nearly 50,000 people chose to be members of Wisconsin Public Radio. Their support makes it possible for thousands more to be informed and inspired every day. Learn more at WPR.org.
Support also comes from Madison College Continuing Education, offering more than 400 professional or personal enrichment workshops, seminars, and non-credit classes. Information at madisoncollege.edu/keeplearning.
By a frame company in Oshkosh. So, I was just curious.
Well, you say it's a picture. We want to determine what kind of picture. First, you mentioned photo, and then you said it's not a photo. So is it a picture like from a magazine? Or?
No, I don't think so. It seems to have a linen texture to it.
Okay. It might be a print of this picture. And they, for a while, they did prints on linen textures, or even they did them on kind of a board and then made a texture on it to make it kind of look like a painting. But that's a thing we'd have to look if it's a painting or not. Probably not a real high value on it. I would say maybe $25 to $50 or something like that. Without his autograph, it doesn't bring a lot of money.
Thank you for calling, Judy. And Shirley, thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Well, thank you. It's been great fun.
Shirley Bauman, owner of Bauman Auction Services and Heirloom Appraisal and Estate Services, and you can find links to her services on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you will find them right there. Thank you very much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.